Hello. Have you ever had the blues?
Well, maybe you're having trouble grinding your teeth. Hi, I'm Dr. James K. Mantle Ray.
And I'm Dr. Robert Muramoto. Do you suffer from anxiety?
PTSD, body dysmorphia, hypoactive sexual desire disorder. It doesn't matter.
We can fix you.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if my film genre, or if my trauma, personal trauma, was a film genre, it would be like a film noir set in high school, like Brick, sorta.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and if my personal trauma were a film genre, it would be a Wes Andersonian quirky family dramedy.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were experiencing my trauma in some sort of film genre, mine would almost certainly be a horror movie set inside an old Catholic monastery. It's basically The Nun. I'm not even sure what the trauma is there. I just know that that's how it would manifest.
Yes. Hopefully our answers will make sense to you as we talk this week about the works of director Cary Fukunaga and the upcoming Netflix series Maniac, which will start streaming this weekend. It is maybe about the things we talked about in some way. But first, welcome to Storm Spoilers. We're a pop culture podcast. We're supported by our patrons at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. We like our Maester and Small Council levels so much, we give them a bonus segment. This week's bonus segment, we're going to break down some things of the new Captain Marvel trailer that hit this week. Brie Larson is the first female solo titular superhero to get a movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We'll break it down for you. And also, patrons, and just people in general who are fans of Emmy-winning Game of Thrones, best drama series of the past year, Con of Thrones, next year, July 12th through 14th in Nashville. Tickets are going to be available soon. That's going to be post-Game of Thrones season, so it's going to be off the hook with better references than off the hook.
And allegedly, we will be there, but, I mean...
Allegedly.
We have not received our official invite yet, so...
The spoilers are going to be off the chain. The chains are coming off the spoilers.
I like that this is the public venue we've decided to all learn. We haven't actually been invited yet. Free advertising, Con of Thrones, July 12th through 14th. Back in Nashville.
I mean, they'd be silly not to invite us at this point.
I'm just saying, if our listeners want to message them and be like, if Storm of Spoilers isn't there, we riot, I wouldn't complain.
Everybody tweet at them. Maybe this is how we'll start getting into all the cons. We'll just have our legion of fans tweet at the con and demand great debates.
Yeah. But I'm wary of mob justice in this way.
But Dave, but, this is the best kind of mob justice.
I say, like, used sparingly.
Yeah, okay. Definitely Con of Thrones, though.
All right.
I'm sure they're open to suggestions.
Yes. Certainly they're not working on it and just really nice people working year-round and, you know, trying to put together programming.
That's actually true.
So, you know, okay, how about this? If we know Game of Thrones air dates for sure, and we don't know if we're going to be at Con of Thrones, then maybe we gotta kick up some dust. That seems like that would be ridiculous. But right now, programming's up in the air. Maybe we're gonna get a reach out for help before we get a reach out for...
I'm sure we will. I did not mean to make this a thing. I just wanted to point out that technically we have not been invited yet, but probably we will be.
Very good to know. Con of Thrones, it's a good time. We've been at the other two ones. So we got to keep it 100%. Joanna, do we have any reviews this week?
We have so many new reviews, and I really want to thank all of you. I cannot read all of them, but I will read a few of them. This one comes from, oh my goodness, Platypus 52852829248. I guess Platypus 1 through 52852829247. Taken. But this is 5 stars, Fortnite tomatoes and spaghetti on chili. Love listening to both.
Oh my God.
Love listening both to both the on and off season tour for all things Game of Thrones and pop culture movies, reviews, etc. I've been a fan for years. Since you all are running low on reviews, I thought I'd chime in. I'm from Eastern Kentucky, and the one thing we love here is our seasonal garden tomatoes. I love to go in my backyard and pick them straight off the vine for a caprese. We have all four seasons here, and I cannot wait for fall, cold weather, and chili in all forms. As a former Cincinnatian, nation? Cincinnati? What do you say? Someone from Cincinnati, home of Scott.
I'm not going to say what people from Cleveland call people from Cincinnati.
Okay. Oh, gosh. All right. Home of Skyline chili and spaghetti in your chili is perfectly normal. It's called a three-way. Oh, my goodness. Cincinnati,
this is a family show.
You are fascinating. Final thoughts. I have a 13, 15, and 16-year-old, so I'm very familiar on Fortnite battle passes and skins as I see the charges coming out of my bank account. It has gotten so serious that kids nowadays carry their flat-screen TVs and Xboxes to each other's houses, as it's not good enough to play online across town from each other. They think they need to be sitting beside each other. I came home from work one day this summer, and my 13-year-old had four friends over, and my living room looked like CIA headquarters. Thankfully, school... or rather, Fortnite Detox is back in session. Love you guys. This episode made me want to eat garden tomatoes on top of chili while playing a 4-hour game of Fortnite. Lauren. So, thank you, yeah. Lauren.
Praise Pete the Tomato God.
We have so many other reviews, but I cannot get to all of them. I really appreciate them. I did want to read one more. From Mike 3A22AD, 5 stars, love the pod, hate the cross episode storms. Okay. Hello from a devoted fan in Cairo, Egypt. I posted a review earlier and you guys never read it. Sorry. Mike, I hope this one makes it into an episode. I came across this podcast on Spotify during the off season tour. Before season 7, I've been hooked ever since. Actually went back and listened to almost all the previous episodes and have since then extended to listen to some fighting in the war room just to get more. Except you guys cover several topics in single episodes on that podcast, so it's kind of tough to listen since I try to stay storm free. I love the chemistry between the hosts, and even though I sometimes disagree with what they say, I find myself curious to hear them out. I was even trying to plan my vacation time around Con of Thrones just so I could meet them in person, but couldn't do to work. I'm sure you guys have been told this 1,000 times, but I really do feel like I'm having a conversation with friends. In part of the world where having friends to have in-depth pop culture discussions with is kind of hard. Thank you for that. I do have one favor to ask. I realize that when I decide to listen to an episode about a show movie that I forfeit the right to remain unspoiled. But what happens is sometimes I'm listening to an episode about a completely different topic and something else casually comes up and that gets spoiled despite actively avoiding listening to the episode about that actual topic until I watch it. A spoiler warning there would be awesome, guys, at least. Keep up the great work. P.S. I would ask Joanna to read this review in a Middle Eastern accent, but I fear that would complicate things. I read that before I started the review and I was like, indeed, I will not be doing that. Fair play to some of the spoiler warnings, and I will try to be more aware of that, especially like around like recent things, you know.
Shout out to Egypt, though. That's cool.
We will spoil Tremors, but maybe.
Oh, yeah. Okay, all well, Tremors
we,
spoilers.
We can cover some things right off the bat. Tremors, previously aired episodes of Game of Thrones,
sure.
The 90s Lost in Space movie.
Yeah. The TV show Lost.
I'm going to say, like, yeah, the TV show Lost. Star Wars movies that are out. These are just all, like, conversational unavoidabilities, yeah. I think.
Also, the end of Game of Thrones.
As soon as we know it. It's all building to that. Then we have to wait, like, 8 months till there's a spinoff. What would that feel like?
8 whole months?
That would be crazy.
Anyway, thank you all for your reviews. Please keep leaving them. I really appreciate you guys stepping up with a few when we were running low, and I will get to hopefully all of them in due time.
Excellent. Neil, now that the East Coast of America is safe from dangerous storms, what's it safe for us to do again?
Oh, it's safe to go storm chasing. And I'd like to start this week with mine. I think this week I actually summon the bad takes demon that lives inside of Sean Penn. because on over last weekend I started watching Hulu's The First, which is the Sean Penn led show from Bo Willimon, the House of Cards guy. And it's about basically it's set in like 2030. It's about the first mission to Mars and how it's actually about to happen. And there's a few things I did not expect. One, I hate that Sean Penn is such a good actor because he's really good in the show. And then two, it's not really about space travel, which I thought was interesting. And as we're going to experience as we talk more about Maniac this week, I've been watching a lot of stuff that's just about like grief and mental health and the things we carry with us in loss. And, so the Hulu's The First is less Apollo 13 and more, or it's less like The Martian and it's more like House of Cards, NASA edition. So, but it's very good. I'm almost through it. And, literally within 12 hours of me tweeting something nice about this show, Sean Penn came out this week and said something very stupid about the Me Too movement. And like I said, it's like I summoned the bad take demon. So I won't blame you if people don't take this recommendation. Like, minimizing your Sean Penn intake is totally fine in my book. That's a version of self-care, and I think that's important. But I, as a space nerd, really have enjoyed this, despite the fact that it's really not even about space travel. It's kind of about the politics of space travel and then a bunch of other intimate character drama.
Is it about the banking of space travel? Because you're really barking up my tree.
There's some finance stuff in there. There's there's lobbying. There's deals being made with Congress about how much this is going to cost. There's venture capital themes.
Damn it. I'm going to have to watch this series after it became problematic again.
So anyway, so it's actually really good. I mean, I don't really doubt that Bo Willimon, who did House of Cards, can deliver a really good first season, because that's what House of Cards was. So I'm interested to see. I actually think this is part one. It's the first 10 episodes. It might be part one of two, but I'm curious to see where it goes after this sort of first season that doesn't take place in space, apparently. So that is mine. But apparently this over the last weekend, I was not watching The Big Thing, but I think Joanna was watching The Big Thing that a lot of people on the Twitters were talking about. So, what you got?
No, I actually like relented. So Netflix has a series that you might have heard of called BoJack Horseman, which is an animated series about a formerly famous, currently famous horse who suffers from depression and the like Hollywood characters who sort of swirl around him. And every year or every time a new season comes out, all these TV critics who I respect are like, oh man, BoJack Horseman, best depiction of mental health, mental illness on television ever. Oh my God, it's amazing. And that was fighting up against my personal issue, which is that I cannot stand to listen to Will Arnett talk. Those two things.
Which I guess explains why you might avoid that show.
Those two things were in like hard conflict for me for years. And finally, I finally gave in and watched BoJack Horseman. And it is fantastic. So, you know.
Have you watched all of it?
Not all of it, but like most of it. And I like skipped because I had already tried with season one and it didn't like the first few episodes didn't really work for me. So I skipped season one. Anyway, I have watched all the way through the most recent season. And, it's extraordinary. And we're going to talk about the depiction of mental health, and mental illness on screen, a bit more when we get to our main subject matter, which is Maniac by Cary Fukunaga. But, I will say that the depiction of mental illness as someone who has been in therapy for like most of their adult life, like is really, stunning, and the depiction of addiction issues and all of that. So I'm really impressed with BoJack. And it's like, it's also just deeply entertaining and really funny satire of Hollywood. The amount, like, comparing season one, where it was like mostly Paul F. Tompkins and like Patton Oswalt doing like the various extra voices, to like the sheer roster of voice talent they get now. Like every episode has like five actors that you've heard of and liked, doing roles. And the fact that this current season made fun of like, dark prestige drama. was really, really good. So yeah, BoJack Horseman. It's as good as they say. I got over my Will Arnett thing. I still don't want to see Lego Batman, the end.
Yeah. Well, also it's Aaron Paul's second best role for sure.
Well, what's funny is if you go back and watch season one of what that character was in season one, it's completely changed. Season one, right. He was like an actual person. Now he's just like a parody of an approximation of a human. So, but they do, you know, they touch on some really interesting things. They touch on the Me Too movement in a way that, I found very sharp. They didn't like really dive. They kind of came at it sideways in a way that I really, thought was interesting. So there you go.
Nice. Yeah. I got that on my list for post Fantastic Fest. It's a little cheer up after Fantastic Fest.
Yeah, nothing cheerier than BoJack Horseman. There's one episode that's just a eulogy the whole episode.
Oh, God.
Like, I was watching it, and I was like, 10 minutes in, and I was like, is this just going to be? So I just, like, scrubbed the little, like, bar across the whole episode. I was like, yep, that's what it's just this. Just one shot. Okay, I'll go back to where I was and do this whole thing. So, yep.
Clever. All right, Dave, what do you got for us this week?
So, a little preview of Storm of Spoilers listening in the future. In mid-Halloween, mid-October Halloween season, we're going to be doing Halloween the franchise because there's going to be a new Halloween movie that these two chuckleheads are seeing this weekend. And I am seeing later. But in preparation, I of course have to see all the Halloween movies.
Of course.
Most of which I have not seen before.
Of course. But of course. Yes. You're legally bound to see every single Halloween movie.
Look, if I gave that dignity to the Predator, denying it to Halloween would feel like a slap across the face. All right. So, I let our, you know, Patreon Slack members know that this was coming up and that there is a whopping 10 movies to catch up with before the new one, should they want to. And in case we don't want to go crazy in October, I was like, let's, you know, I'm going to parse these out over several weekends. You guys can too if you want. So this weekend I did Halloween's 1 through 4, which are
that's
original
parsing
classic.
It out.
Yeah, that's just, well, I mean, you know, bit by bit. See, the thing I wasn't counting on was really liking Halloween 1 enough to immediately want to start Halloween 2, because I know they kind of like go back to back, even though production wise, that's not necessarily how it worked out, because they wanted Halloween to be an anthology series, which wasn't blah, 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 till 3. Burn a lot of pod for October here, but super fun watching these Halloween movies. The thing is, they're not all available on streaming. The best place I've found for that's going to have Halloween, I don't think it has it yet, because what they're doing is adding a new movie every day in October, is Shudder is going to have the Halloween series. That's where the streaming is going to eventually pop up. But they're doing it as a promotion for October, so you're going to have to wait. But if you have Halloween movies around, one of the 10, then maybe start watching Halloween and collecting your thoughts, because we're going to be chasing that storm as a group later on in October.
Horror is not really my genre, generally. And a couple years ago, I was dating someone who was sort of astonished by the number of like classic horror films I hadn't seen, like Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween. I've seen a few, like basically every classic horror film I've seen is something that like a close friend or a boyfriend has shown me in like shock and disgust that I haven't seen it myself. And that's like true of Rosemary's Baby and The Omen and The Exorcist and all, and The Thing and all of that sort of stuff. And so Halloween, I only saw for the first time, I think it was like 2 years ago. And, I want to say it was between Stranger Things season one and Stranger Things season two. I think that's correct. And what I know is that I was watching it. It's really good, the first Halloween. And I was watching it and I was like, oh, I mean, I already understood kind of what they were going for, but I was like, oh, this is really what they're going for. I mean, it's that mixed with like the stuff we talked about, kids on bikes, Amblin sort of stuff, but like that, like the soundtrack, which is so famous from Halloween, and just like people walking down streets and fall leaves crunching and all that sort of stuff. It's like, it's just a mood. There's so much mood in that first movie. So,
yeah. Yes. Anyway, Halloween. Start watching it. You have 10 movies in like 4 weeks. So figure it out.
Figure it out.
Figure it out.
All right. We're back to talk about Cary Fukunaga stuff. We're going to talk about the movies first. I want to hand it off here to somebody who's more, I guess, better versed beyond Sin Nombre at the beginning of his career, because I have a gap between Sin Nombre and True Detective Season 1, or if I did see Jane Eyre, I don't remember it, as occasionally happens to me with period pieces. Oh, I thought that would piss Joanna off enough to just immediately step in. We could talk about Sin Nombre first if you want.
We should talk about Sin Nombre, which was his, I mean, I'll just say this briefly as an overview before, handing it off to Neil, who is, I think, the person who knows Sin Nombre best out of all of us. But, you know, Cary Fukunaga, who was like a professional snowboarder before he became a director, like director is something that he came to as like almost a second career in life. And that asshole is really, really good at it. He started with Sin Nombre. He made Jane Eyre, which he made, you know, specifically as sort of a response to Sin Nombre, in that, you know, Sin Nombre is like an independent, like, filled with Mexican slang, sort of like small modern issues film. And he's like, cool, I'm going to show people that I can also make like a period piece with Michael Fassbender in it and stuff like that, you know, just to show them my range. And so that's why he did Jane Eyre. When he did Jane Eyre, like, I think people really did sit up and take notice even more than they did when he did Sin Nombre. And then that's how he got True Detective Season 1, which he directed all of the episodes of True Detective Season 1, and he did not, he, you know, I think he had sort of an acrimonious parting of the ways with creator Nick Pizzolatto, which means he did not work on Season 2, even though he has a producing credit on True Detective. It's sort of just nominal at this point. And I think it is very apparent that Cary Fukunaga did not work on True Detective Season 2, but Dave and I can fight about that later. And then he did this film for Netflix, Beast of No Nation, starring Idris Elba, which is about you know, child soldiers in Africa. And that was for Netflix. And that was like this big, that was another big, like, basically wherever Cary Fukunaga goes, he's doing something kind of like bold and new. Like True Detective was one of the first, if not the first, prestige TV show where one director directed all the episodes and made it feel like one sort of long movie. Beasts of No Nation was Netflix's, I think this is right, Netflix's first like bid at an Oscar movie. It didn't really pan out for Beasts of No Nation, but it premiered at Toronto. They screened it in movie theaters as well as streamed it on Netflix. And then Cary Fukunaga had like a long dry spell where he had a couple projects that didn't get off the ground, like It. He was attached to write and direct It, and eventually got booted from that project. The Alienist, which also is a project that he left, that wound up airing on TNT this summer. But I don't know a ton of people who are still talking about The Alienist, until finally he did Maniac for Netflix. So that's sort of my broad overview of Cary Fukunaga. Does anyone have any comments or corrections about
that? No, that's a good arc.
Well, and I think that beyond that, he, he started his career working in a lot of short films. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a couple short projects that he worked on, sort of in that same period around Sin Nombre, that were about immigration, and they're about immigrants in the United States. So it's a very passionate subject for him. Mm-hmm. And I thought that sort of defined a lot of his early work. And I think it sort of caps off with Sin Nombre in 2009. And then, yeah, he's had a really interesting, I think he's one of those directors, or creatives, I guess, that you sort of take note of, because you know he's always sort of doing something interesting and dynamic. And I remember It, when they announced that he was going to be doing It, was sort of it felt like an out of left field choice, but also it sort of felt right. I'm not sure what really went wrong there. But just like Maniac, you know, I think what we'll get into is that his films, especially his most recent stuff, the more he grows as a storyteller, is all very unique and not at all what you might expect. So I think that's sort of the through line of his career so far. And yeah, Sin Nombre is one of the best debut films I've seen in a long time. Like it's like, you know, you go back and watch early films from Alfonso Cuarón, or I don't want to say somebody like Stanley Kubrick, but there's, you know, there's just like you just feel, it feels different.
Yeah.
When you're watching something that he has made, and something where he has sort of authorship. So Cary Fukunaga is a name that comes up when we talk about modern auteurs.
Yeah.
So this idea of having full authorship over whatever you're doing. And I think that has also gotten him in trouble a couple times. You know, he's left projects, you know, over creative differences, and that might be part of it, but I think, you know, it's a risk reward scenario.
Well, the thing there's this really good profile of him on GQ. There's also a good profile on him of New York Times. Willa Paskin wrote the New York Times one, and Zach Baron wrote the GQ one. But he talks about leaving It as like, he was like, it's not that I was difficult to work with. It's that they thought they were afraid I would be, or something like that. I'm like, here's the deal. Like, if it's gonna, knowing what I know of Nick Pizzolatto, the creator, I guess, of True Detective, if there was a creative difference on True Detective season one, I would put that largely at the feet of Nick Pizzolatto, cause that dude does Right. not seem like a good dude. If Cary Fukunaga then got a reputation for being hard to work with from that project, and that sort of infected his dealings with other people. I mean, that's sort of his version of it, is that like he had a reputation for being difficult to work with and uncompromising in a way that like made it that, you know, the producers on It, you know, thought it would be, he would be a problem on that project. I don't know what happened with The Alienist. But what's interesting about the GQ profile, and we can get into this more when we like really talk more about Maniac, is that he said that he sat down, whether like, because he had learned his, I don't know, learned his lesson, because he had decided he like really, really did not want the reputation of being too uncompromising in vision, or whether it was true all along that Cary Fukunaga is not the person like who deserves that reputation. Apparently the Netflix gave him really strong notes about like due to algorithmic data about what Maniac not should be, but like I almost want to say like the shape and the rhythm of the season. And he was like, and I took like pretty much all of their notes. He was just sort of like, so this idea that I'm uncompromising, I mean, I don't know. I tend to believe
it's like
him.
I seem pretty chill.
I think I'm cool. I think I'm fun to work with. So I don't know.
Think honestly though, it reminds me of like the way Christopher Nolan was early on.
Yeah.
You know, he started to get that perfectionist reputation, but it's one of those things where most of it's probably not true. Some of it might be, but also he's so talented that once you sort of give him his own free rein, it usually works out. So I think that's what we're really experiencing with Maniac. But that's really fascinating about the Netflix thing. It's weird. I can't believe that they haven't used that data to make shorter Marvel series seasons yet.
Well, but. I almost wonder if that's a case where like Jeff Loeb of Marvel TV is like, cool note. Nope. Dave, I feel like you would know more than Neil or I would about what happened, with it. Perhaps you do. I don't know. What are your thoughts on what happened with Cary Fukunaga's, version of it?
So the story, as I remember it, is he was brought on to do an adaptation of It. He submitted a draft that was two movies, a kid movie and an adult movie. And then they said, how about one movie? And he did some passes on it. And then whatever happened with creative differences happened, making it appear at the time that what had happened is he said, this can't be one movie. However, now that it has been released, with Andy Muschietti as the director, Cary Fukunaga still has a writing credit. And when that movie came out, it was supposed to be the one movie It. So we don't really know now that there's going to be an It Part 2, how much of the Cary Fukunaga of it seeped into It, or necessarily what the break happened. But at the time when the studios were asked about it, they said creative differences, and like the buzzing was that it was he couldn't get a one movie script under budget, so he just didn't want to do it.
So the truth is we'll probably never know until later. And I mean, like, it's too bad because basically I think it's too bad that we've had to wait this long for another Cary Fukunaga project. But at the same time, like, you know, the Muschietti It is great. So, you know, it's not like I'm sitting here being like, you know, like, I think that's one of those movies where, yeah, it's sort of like with Ant-Man and Edgar Wright. I think people were so like, so enamored of Cary Fukunaga that they were like, went into it expecting it to be like this bad, shitty, like, whatever. If only we could have gotten the Cary Fukunaga version, except it was good. And so everyone was just sort of like, oh, okay. Well.
Yeah, no one's creating hashtags to release the Cary Fukunaga cut. It worked out just fine. But I understand their excitement because honestly, that single shot in True Detective Season 1 is just amazing. Like, it's just great.
Yeah. Do you guys feel like Cary Fukunaga has like a style, a visual style that you feel like you can latch onto? I don't, but
I don't know if there's a visual style, but I do think that his style is like a distinctly visual one. Like, I know that we're talking like down this auteur angle, which I mostly get, but then to hear him talk about True Detective Season 1 now and that GQ profile and being like, it was basically just a police procedural, so I decided to like spice it up the best I could, makes me sort of like go back and think, and like basically he's a like a feel bad director. Like he's gonna take things that you don't really want to watch, and he's gonna find a way to present them to you that makes them compelling. This is all with the exception of Jane Eyre, which again don't remember if I've seen, but it's sort of why I think Maniac, the tone of Maniac was a little bit jarring to me, is because I would have associated Cary Fukunaga's, like, it would have been like a gritty It. Like, it would have felt like it was real. They probably wouldn't have updated the time period. This would have been like, here are your fucking references. This clown's gonna eat these kids. And maybe would have taken more realistic or mystic tone to it. Which I think, the Muschietti's made it much more of like a monster movie. And the only reason I expected that is because Sin Nobre, it's so bleak, but you can't look away. And because True Detective Season 1 is like notable for performance and like that camera shot and like very slowly the details of the plot outside of the Yellow King have like left me behind. And then obviously Beasts of No Nation is just living in that world for long enough and having to like reckon with it, which I guess Sin Nobre is too, but equally so.
I think, sorry.
No, please do.
Well, And I think this actually goes to some of his roots, which is he came up as a cinematographer. And I think a lot of that, if I were to describe his visual style, it would be it's both steady and it sort of creates space. Like, he uses a lot of big wide shots. He uses a lot of very still cinematography. And it creates this room for the audience to sort of add or really think about what's happening in any particular scene that he's, creating. And I think that's important because, you think about like music video directors, like the Zack Snyders and Michael Bay's of the world and how it's all quick cuts. It's a lot of camera motion. Cary Fukunaga is very steady handed and meticulous. And I think that really came out to me in Maniac because it's not even necessarily about the tone. Feel good, feel bad, feel whatever. It's about the meticulousness and the slow purpose of the way he presents things visually. And I think that that makes it more interesting and probably makes some of these, topics more palatable. Cause you're right. He definitely chooses stuff that is not stuff I would immediately want to see a movie or a TV show about.
Well, right. And he, now that I think about it, now that I asked you guys and I was like, I don't think he has a visual style, do you? I now disagree with myself. And I would say that the one thing I would say is that no matter what the genre, even in Maniac, though, obviously there are aspects of Maniac that are so high fantasy that they have a gloss to them, he does like a really naturalistic approach. The Jane Eyre that he did, is famous. It's funny because I didn't know anything about Cary Fukunaga. I didn't know about Sin Nombre when that Jane Eyre came out. It was before I was like doing this professionally. And, I just saw his name and actually, I mean, like, please don't tell my bosses, but I saw his name. And I thought it was a Japanese woman who had directed this movie. instead of a Japanese American Swedish man, who lived in the Bay Area, is from Alameda and lived in Sebastopol, which is a tiny town that I lived in too, and stuff like that. Like, and so when I saw the Jane Eyre, like, I still thought it was by this Japanese woman, and I was thinking about, like, the Ang Lee Sense of Sensibility and this, like, interesting, like, Asian approach to, like, British period drama. And then I, like, literally Googled one thing and was like, oh.
My take!
No! But, thinking of, even before I saw True Detective, just that first trailer for True Detective, when you see, Matthew McConaughey just looking so like, not even in the older shots, in the younger, just looking worn and like sweaty. And the same is true of Jane Eyre, where like, usually the idea with period drama is you go like super fussy and precise and glossy. And he went like really naturalistic and like Mia Wasikowska just looks like wind whipped all the time and stuff like that, And so, you would expect that style from something like Sin Nombre, which is like so small and so like, almost documentary in style. But the fact that he applies it, I think, to all these other things he's trying, and I think you see some of it in Maniac, even though you get this other stuff that's like very high fantasy. So I don't know. But like even with, are we ready to talk about Maniac now? I just want to talk about Maniac.
No. If you weren't done, please continue.
No, I am. I just want to like, my very next thought is of Maniac. So yeah.
Well, no, it's funny. Oh, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the sort of wornness of it because, speaking of Maniac, all of the sort of analogness of that movie that exists in what I presume is the future. So I think that that's part of it. Like his worlds all feel extremely lived in, even if it's like in this case, actually it's a good place to start. When the hell does Maniac take place?
All right. Yeah. We're going to do a calm section on Maniac. It is a Netflix limited series. It is 10 episodes. It'll be out this weekend in September. And then we're going to take a break, and then we're going to do a Storm section on Maniac. So just knowing going forward here, Maniac the Calm, does Maniac take place in the future? Joanna Robinson.
Yes, but I will say, This is something that, you know, humble brag. I was talking to Alex Garland last Friday. And I was talking to Alex Garland, who did Annihilation and Ex Machina and is working on a new FX series. And he talked about how his preferred sort of kind of sci-fi is, takes place, he calls it takes place 10 minutes in the future. So like it's a future that looks so recognizably like our life, but there's just a few tweaks here and there. One fun conceit that I actually like didn't get the first time it happened in Maniac is this idea that like if you have no money, but like you want to ride the subway or you want to buy something to eat or something like that, you can get, I forget what it's called. It's like an ad buddy or something like that. You get a,
it's literally called, it ad, called
ad buddy. Okay. Yeah. You get a person sitting next to you pitching you ads. It's just a human sitting next to you. And that's how like you buy your ride on the subway is if you are willing to put up with this person sitting next to you pitching you on concepts. It's sort of like your Hulu. Like, do you want your ad-free Hulu experience or do you want to watch the same commercial for like Capital One over and over again or whatever it is? That kind of stuff. And then like the pooper scooper robot. That's another aspect that's like near future where there's just like a robot that roams the city picking up dog shit. Those two things are the things that immediately spring to mind. There's other things, obviously, like the look of Jonah Hill's apartment. And obviously, like, the pharmaceutical stuff, you know, is futuristic.
The Brooklyn Library is a train station now.
Right, right.
Because I guess books are...
who reads? So all that kind of stuff where, I don't know, and I love this world. It's not, what was that Justin Theroux, movie?
Mute.
It's not, I love that I called it a Justin Theroux movie. It's not,
you know, that one that will be memorable forever as being the Justin Theroux movie.
It's not so futuristic as Mute. It's much more recent and that I love that kind of, futuristic style. So that's what I would say. 10 minutes in the future. Maniac.
All right.
Do we want to give like,
I would say almost like, it's a little bit sideways.
Sure. Could be that too. Yeah.
Like it's almost like, iPhones never happened. Like imagine if you didn't have a computer in your pocket, but otherwise the world progressed as it normally would. Because there's definitely on wall phones in this world.
Good point. But you have someone, you have the idea of doing that kind of analog futuristic where, and this is what we're talking about lived in, when you have someone like the actress Sonoya Mizuno plays this like sort of lab leader, de facto leader of the lab. And she's got kind of this like fuzzy, awkward, blunt haircut. She carries herself in a funky posture. She wears like, you know, whatever unattractive sweaters, has huge glasses.
She looks like somebody tried to cross Sia with, the lady who hates capes from The Incredibles.
I think just today they released a promo with her and Theroux and one other person that is actually the promo that I wish I had watched instead of just the flashy color promo one.
Right.
Because I think that one actually gives an idea of what the series's overall tone is, which is that Maniac is like a black comedy that also is about the interconnectivity of things like amoebas. That's how we start. And then it sort of grows out of there into a medical experiment.
But, like, Sonoya's look, I think there's this idea that the future needs to be, like, antiseptically clean, and you could think of a, Sonoya Mizuno is a kind of actress who really, really disappears into every role that she does, and she was in Ex Machina, she's actually in Annihilation, she plays the, like, weird blobby body double of Natalie Portman. She's in La La Land, which might be the Emma Stone connection. She's the bride, in Crazy Rich Asians. So you've seen her in something, even if you didn't know you saw her in something. And she is like a deeply beautiful and elegant woman. And I can see a version of this story that's almost like, I don't know, Cloud Atlas or something like that, where you get a future that is like all clean white surfaces and antiseptic. And you see her and she's like a glossy Bob and like all this sort of stuff, but like to have her like constantly cigarette dangling out of her mouth, elbows akimbo, like her whole style and look just really to me grounds the story in a kind of future that I'm really compelled by. And Emma Stone, similarly, they never try to pretend that Emma Stone is ugly. That's a preposterous thing to try to do. But the way that she styled, in her, you know, real world persona, and especially, in these sequences, they have a lot of actors undergo where like a million different cameras are on them in different close ups. You know, they just let her be like slightly frizzy haired and, you know, probably very minimal makeup. And it's just sort of like, it just feels real. It doesn't feel perversely frumpy. It just feels like, yeah, this is what Emma Stone looks like. All the better to contrast it to when she's playing like, you know, a film noir dame or like a screwball comedy dame or something like that later on, you know? And, I love the look of Maniac.
Neil, would you like to explain what Joanna just said? Why would this?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why would this normal-looking person look like a screwball comedy dame?
So let's back up a little bit.
Oh, sorry.
Guys. No. This is good because the look of it is really, I think, what is attracting a lot of people to it. The rest of it seems fairly confusing. So I'm going to do my best to explain what the hell this show is about. So it's about a couple of lonely people. Let's say lonely for different reasons. Emma Stone plays Annie and Jonah Hill plays Owen, and Annie and Owen sort of intersect in some weird ways at the very beginning. You know, they kind of see each other on the street. And we get to learn about some of their, afflictions, some of the mental health issues that they're struggling with. And this ultimately leads them to, they're both sort of down on their luck. He was just laid off at his job. She loves drugs. And so they both end up at this pharmaceutical trial for a variety of reasons. And they end up in together. And this trial is a system that is supposed to unlock with three pills. It's supposed to help you recognize your trauma, it's supposed to help you recognize your blind spots, and then it's supposed to help you confront your trauma. And the goal of this whole thing is to cure you of your mental health issue. And it's sort of, at the beginning led by, what's that actor's name? Who's really great? Who plays Robert, Dr. Muramoto from, Kanda, who I just swear that I just saw in something else that was fun. And it was invented by this gentleman and Dr. Hold on. Gotta read this name to you. Dr. James Mantle-Ray, played by Justin Theroux. He comes into the picture a little bit later.
Theroux is so good.
It's so crazy. So it's all about these weird doctors and their weird experiment, and they have basically these mind machines that they put people in. They give them the pill, A, B, or C pill for each stage of the test. And they go into their thoughts, and not only do the people who are the subjects are being tested, but there is also this AI, this artificial intelligence computer named Gertie, who is going in with them into their visions. And Gertie is really the one that is helping them along. So it's all about then. Most of the show exists sort of in their minds or within the test, and it's about them confronting trauma and sort of, and then weird stuff starts happening, I guess. I would say
from a visual standpoint, we go into the tests with them.
Yes.
A couple of times, and those tests take the form of different scenarios. It's not necessarily always us reliving a moment as it happened because it's happening in their mind. So we revisit a perspective on what happened, which is
right.
How sometimes we could be in the 30s doing like some sort of old school heist comedy,
or
we could be in the 80s doing another caper. But those are bad two examples to put back and forth.
Or Emma Stone shows up as a drunken elf with messed up ears. Yes, so, it does happen. And I think what ends up happening is you have these two stories that are happening parallel. There is the story of Annie and Owen and their experiences and their dealing with their trauma. And then there's this whole other world that is happening just in the next room between Sonoya Mizuno's Dr. Fujita and Dr. Mantle Ray, and eventually another character who I feel like it's almost a spoiler to mention, but we'll talk about it more, I guess, in the next segment. And it's just like this, it's like a, how do you describe that storyline? It's also about mental illness, but just sort of different.
Well, yes. The thing I want to say, and thank you. Sorry, I went too far forward. Let's pull it back. But I will plus what Neil said and say that, like, you know, people have asked me sort of what tone Maniac strikes. A lot of people, I think, were afraid that a lot of people who were put off by Legion in the way that it sort of just goes too far, perhaps sometimes into like subjective mental health realities, that some people found incomprehensible. They were worried about Maniac. And then, similarly, just this idea of, I don't know, the cutification of mental, illness. And I'm thinking of, Legion, I think, sort of, I don't know, flirts with this occasionally, but, stuff like, Silver Linings Playbook or Betty and June, this idea that, like, oh, isn't it quirky? They've got mental health issues, but they found each other, and that's so cute. And I just don't think Maniac ever does that. As someone who, like, has had mental health issues and has been in therapy, like, do you ever watch something and you're like, I think I like this, but I'm really afraid what people, you know, like, who have had this experience and I haven't are going to say?
Do normal people have that experience, or is it just people who write about movies?
It might be people who get screeners, and I'm like, in my vacuum, I like this, but what if I find out that it's deeply problematic in some way that I can't see from my perspective? Anyway.
So what if the press tour is just they abandon the only female star? Why?
But like, so I was worried about that for Maniac. I was like, oh my God, what if like people who have had mental health like issues are like Maniac is exploitative of that? And then I was like, oh wait, no, I've had mental health issues. I get to be like, from my subjective perspective, I think this is the show that takes all of that, and treats it with respect. And, the closest sort of tonality that I would put it, next to is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but it, which is an obvious comparison, but it has the benefit of having more time, and dual gender perspective. So it's not just, you know, like Eternal Sunshine, for as much as I love that, that is the Joel, the Jim Carrey story, right? This mm-hmm. gives equal time to Annie and Owen and these other characters that Neil mentioned, and that I think makes it even stronger from my point of view. So,
yeah, and I think Emma Stone is doing such a good job here that so much Annie comes through. I would say there might even be a little less Owen than Annie in some of these shared things.
Well, yeah, particularly
that's such an Owen thing to do, though.
Well, yeah, that is such an Owen thing.
Particularly because Jonah Hill has made a choice, you know, and like I like Jonah Hill a lot, and we know that Jonah Hill can go big, as he does. Gentle spoiler alert: like at the very end of the season, they're like, "Okay, Jonah, give us a big one." But for most of the season, he's going very muted. And I like it, and it works for me, and it reminds me of Jim Carrey in Eternal Sunshine. But he is, yeah, he is kind of like a blank cipher-esque character for much of the TV show. And so, yeah, the original Maniac, I believe it's a Norwegian show. And when I first heard about this and then read about that show, I was a little worried because that show is about a catatonic, you know, a guy who's a loser in real life and he's catatonic, and in his dreams, you know, he gets to live out all these, you know, it's sort of like Secret Life of Walter Mitty, but like a little shittier about women, in terms of like, oh, he's just like, he's so good with the ladies, in his dreams and stuff like that. And I was like, I can't see Emma Stone like signing up to just like feature in some guy's dreams. And so instead it's like it's a two-hander, or as Dave said, like sometimes just an Emma Stone hander. So, you know,
it's a curious time of world building Then it's an Emma Stone one-hander. Then it becomes a Justin Theroux one-hander. Then it goes back to Emma Stone for the end of the series. But I feel like we could get more detail with that.
But I have two more things that I want to say.
All right.
It's interesting that Joanna brought up Legion, because that's where my mind went, because it's the most recent thing that I've watched that's dealt in a serious way with mental health. I found it easier to follow.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So it's less obtuse. And then, yeah, the cast is fantastic. Everybody's great in it, including, but not limited to, Gabriel Byrne, who shows up a little bit, and Jemima Kirk, who shows up a little bit. Really great. And then we're also going to talk about the queen of this entire show that we have not mentioned in the spoiler section.
Also, before we get to the queen, Billy Magnuson, who is one of my favorite handsome guys, who knows exactly how to weaponize his handsomeness for comedy. Which he did really well Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Like, Billy Magnuson is so funny. I find him so funny. And in this, he gets to do sort of like a couple different things. And I think he's really good at all of them. So, yeah.
Yeah. Hard agree.
All right. Maniac is going to be on Netflix this weekend. 10 parts. Cary Fukunaga. Check it out.
All right. It's time, as we do every week, to read some names of some people who are members of our Patreon. Again, it's patreon.com/stormofspoilers. These folks are the elites, the small council, who gets to do all the fun movie clubs with us, which is basically the best part. So here we go. This week I've got Liz Major, I've got Brandy Mandado, I've got Vanessa Marshall, I've got Fanny Martin, Adrian Martinez, Marcus Masciarelli, Summer McCusker, Wade McFarland, Megan McLeod, Megan Meyer, Chris Miracle, Manu Mishra, Delaine Mitchell, Laura Moynihan, and Brian Borowski.
I have, thank you, Natalie Muskin Press, Samba Buteba, Del Nakamura, Savio Wynn, Sosa Odali, Georgia O'Brien. Yes, Joanna.
No.
You're doing great, Dave.
Just gave it my best shot there. Georgia O'Brien, Ben O'Gorman, Chuck Parkey, Danielle, Brianne, Polito, Bryce Quine, JC Quinn, Jackie Quinn. Yep, good to know. Hey, if you are in our Slack, you could DM us a correct pronunciation, and we will put it in this little form right here, and I will not screw it up. Ellen Rabin, thank you very much, and Dennis Ramirez, thank you very much.
Did you say Jennifer Quinn? I think you did, but just making sure.
Jennifer Quinn, also, thank you very much.
All right, I'm going to thank Brian Rapp, Madison Ray, Maddie Ray, Rebels Podcast, Amy Reichert,
Reichert,
Emily Ralph, Rick Russell, Julie S, Katie Selembier, Michael Sample, Chris Saunders, Melanie Shu, Alyssa Scott, Jim Scott, Michael Shanholtz, and Hope Shock. Thank you guys all so much. And yeah, if you want to DM any of us, we have now an ability to sort of put some pronunciation guys in here, but only if you DM us. If you tweet at us, if you email us, blah, 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 that probably won't happen. But if you DM us on Slack, that is the message that we will receive. So thank you all so much.
Thank you for donating. You make it all possible. And we're back to talk spoilers about Maniac.
We need to talk about the queen.
We do need to talk about the queen. Neil, why don't you A, inform us who the queen is, and then B, give us your overall impressions on Maniac.
Yeah, okay, so about halfway through the series. Actually, it's not it doesn't sneak up on you that Sally Field is in this, because she voices the computer. But,
well, I think she's on some ads too.
And she's in some ads. But when Sally Field shows up, this show gets into a different gear, I guess, because she plays Dr. Greta Mansell-Ray, who we very quickly realize is both the basis for Gertie the computer, whose name is actually GRTA, but they call her Gertie, and she's also the mother of Dr. James Mansell-Ray, played by Justin Theroux, who's just having a fucking time of it. And it's really
literally having a computer fucking time of it.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, there's some weird stuff with Justin Theroux
and
Sonoya Mizuno really go all in on this. And I think it's great. There are great performances here from Emma Stone and Jonah Hill, but it's really those two. And then just throwing in a Sally Field firebomb toward the end that just brings this whole thing together. Because it's almost wild and weird and sort of madcap their whole story compared to what is, as, I think Joanna mentioned in the previous segment, a show that's taking these mental illnesses very seriously. But there's also this, some very silly shit going on outside of the room. And I absolutely love that part. And, Sally Field continues to just do her best work. She just fucking rules.
She's like, she's doing like kooky. Well, she gets to do a couple different things because when
she's a crazy aunt the whole time,
but like different kinds of crazy aunts. And my favorite is when Gertie shows, because she plays kind of like this embodiment of Gertie that shows up in the dream worlds. And then also she plays Dr. Mantle Ray, and those are two different, like her introduction as Dr. Mantle Ray is legendary, as far as I'm concerned, because she has this boy toy and this whole thing. But like, when she shows up in the 1930s caper thing, and she she's, I don't know, I was like, that I was so entirely there for
she's
it.
A witch.
Yeah,
she has creepy twins with her at all times. It's just, there's just a lot going on with that lady. And it speaks to what I was talking about with Cary Fukunaga earlier, which is the sort of meticulousness of how weird it gets. Like when the visions that they're seeing start to get strange and start to become less about like what really happened in their lives and more about like the metaphors of what they're dealing with, it gets super weird in very specific ways. And I think I think it's well timed in the season. Like it feels like the progression, and also, and I didn't notice this until Joanna pointed it out as we were talking about, as I was watching it. She's like, did you get to the episodes that are only like 30 minutes long or 20 minutes long? And I was like, no. Yeah. And then I realized that the episode I was watching was only 26 minutes. So there's like a weird rhythm to the show.
That's what
where
I'm
I think
about
it actually,
the algorithm, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So it's like there's this really interesting, very bingeable rhythm to it, where normally I would say that this subject matter-wise is the kind of show that you wouldn't want to watch all together, but I found it really satisfying in basically two big chunks, like just five episodes and then five more episodes. Well, and I probably could have watched it all the way through if it wasn't late at night.
It also, I mean, like, I don't like to lean too heavily on the idea of Easter eggs and stuff like that, but it, like, because you're working in like a subconscious space, there are ways in which themes bleed through from one dream to one dream space to another. So like in your like Jersey dream, you have him like reading Dr. Mantle Ray, which is just like really charming, where he's like reading marriage advice and underlining it with a pencil, and it's like really sweet. But you
and then later when he meets her, he's like, I'm a big fan of all your work.
Yeah,
like,
in real life, I have all your books.
Oh my God.
There's like a few like weird little things that crop up, like moon. There's like this thing of like a moon being a thing that comes up over and over again in these different spaces, or you know, there's just like or names.
Gimlets, why they're all always drinking.
Yeah, gimlets. Or there's a name or like people that Jonah Hill or Emma Stone's characters will have seen in the real world. Like not just their family, but also like, I don't know, this random guy that Emma Stone's character observes early on where she's like, that's what loneliness looks like. And then later he's like one of the first or like mob guys. You know what I mean? It's just sort of yeah. Like these weird repetitions and like that I imagine is kind of what you would do is maybe one would do is incorporate some guy you took notice of. You don't know him, but you took notice of him and then he's in your dream as someone else. And like, and it's not, you know, or the more overt ones, like the guy who writes her up, the guy, the like security guard versus the like, you know, animal protection guy, same guy says literally the same thing to her and stuff like that.
Right.
And
or so, the lady with the very specific squeaky voice.
Right. Exactly. And so it's just like, to me, that denotes like I don't know, that's just like a fun bleeding of real world into fantasy world in a way that doesn't get confusing. Because it's not important that the first or henchman is also that guy she saw earlier. It doesn't matter that it is, but it is. You know what I mean? And so I just loved all of that bleeding stuff. And then also just the dream logic of it all. Like for me, when the dream logic really came through for the first time where I was like, yeah, this I feel like is what dreams are like, is when she's trying to figure out what the code is for the first door, like the back room of the first door, and they've changed it. She's like, what did dancers say before they start? And Jonah's like, 5, 5, 6, 7, 8. She's like, yeah. And she types it in and it works. And it's like, I don't know. It just, I was like,
that's the Gertie code, which is why there's dancing at all.
Oh, I was just really charmed by it. I loved it so much.
I think this series was very fun to watch, but I think going back might be frustrating to me because I think those things are also just like connections, but you can't really nail them down. Like, as like, you know, the Sherlock Holmes part of my mind is wants to be like, the gimlets because this, but like, it doesn't really work out that way.
I think it's just,
so I found myself,
oh, sorry, go ahead, please.
Oh, I found myself sort of reverse algorithming. So I was fed up with the lemur heist going on for as long as it did and wanted more elf time because I thought like those were more meaty parts of the character where, you know, the other one was very entertaining, like comedy and like sort of reference humor. But because we're on pill A, we're still sort of like figuring out how important everything's going to be. So I kept like thinking like, you know, like, oh, he's got a moon jersey on. Like that's moon and that's number one. That's going to be great. Something's going to happen with like the moon. Maybe it's football. Maybe it's going to be like a, you know, Oilers or Viking thing now. I forget which one, the moon quarterback actually is. Not a sports guy. Point being, my brain was sort of like trying to figure it out at that point when I think when later on when I was just sort of basking in the concept, I was much more open to, like, I think the diversion into the Justin Theroux and Sally Fields conflict takes place at the perfect time. I think it's really, it chafed me to have like comedy things up against symbolism things because I didn't know like if tiny papers were important or if gimlets were important or if those were jokes or like thematic beats. So it's like really close to being this one perfect pod of a thing that you could watch and rewatch and all the like little strands connect, but it doesn't. And I think that's intentional. I just think in the end that's frustrated me a little bit more than it sounds like it frustrated both of you.
Well, and it's, I think it's just that, that's their minds creating diversions away. Cause I think that the B pill is really interesting to me because the B pill is supposed to be about identifying your blind spots, which is in my mind. And granted, this is me telling you this with zero knowledge of therapy other than the fact that I studied psychology for like 2 years in college. Nothing, no real knowledge here. But it felt to me like the B pill was sort of reckoning with all the ways their mind tried to divert them away from their real trauma. So right. To me, that stuff just felt like the random shit your mind would make up just so that you didn't have to deal with the really hard stuff.
Which I think is great. Maybe that just needs to be like spoken out to me at some point because it feels like there's stuff like his hawk that's just like a strong through line all the way through. They don't tell you the full story. Then he eventually be like, but he sees a hawk in the intake thing and he becomes, he says it's justice. And then we learn about like the hammer killing and then.
Annie, I'm a hawk.
Yeah. And then he becomes Justice Hawk. And then like it's all like this hawk through line that's just like, no matter what stage you're at, even if you're not in the treatments, you're in the narrative and the narrative knows this is a theme and how to use it cleanly. I wish all of that was that clean. I know I'm asking for like a movie to become an A+ movie, but in terms of my reaction to it, I also, like Neil, took a break, I think around episode 6, And like right as they're about to kick off Sea Pill, and I'm like, I don't know about this, guys. This seems like a lot of episodes about wouldn't it be fun if we got to play some other characters at the other time? And luckily it came to a conclusion. It just wasn't super clean, and it might be anti-algorithm, because once again, in the GQ interview, he talks about having an episode that like unfolded a little bit more on itself and then sort of went in reverse. And I have no idea what that means, but the best parts of Maniac is realizing they're going to try something and then just strapping in and being rewarded for that. And that happens 9 times out of 10 in this series for me. Just, I wish it was 10 times out of 10.
The last one where you get the I don't know, whatever you want to call it, the FBI caper, the whatever. Not the last one, because obviously there's other things.
Oh, like the United Nations aliens thing?
And like Jonah Hill's going so big, doing a voice that like works for me for some reason, and he explains away his voice where he's
isn't
like...
Isn't his name Snorri?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he keeps referring to himself in the third person. Yeah.
And like, and then Emma Stone gets this like ridiculous action sequence that's like a Daredevil hallway fight. It's a John Wick Daredevil hallway fight thing. And then the hawk in that thing is like a little alien and stuff like that. Like, it's just, it's so silly. And like, the thing is, like, what Cary Fukunaga said in a couple different places is like, this was the show where he just wanted to do something really fun and wacky. Like, he was supposed to be able to do something fun and wacky. And yes, exactly what you said, Dave, where this is like a fun acting exercise where like, oh, let's do, I don't know, like a Jersey marital whatever, and then like a 30s caper, and then and then Lord of the Rings, and then whatever it is that Jonah Hill's the mob story that like he's involved in, where he wears that like terrible grill and all that stuff like that, like whatever all of that stuff is.
It's like they get from like Raising Arizona to like,
It is Raising Arizona. I hadn't thought about
it's that. that the husband and wife story is very Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
Meets like Bonnie and Clyde. And then, the last one's very like Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah. But like, that Cary Fukunaga wanted to do that. And then he couldn't, he was like, and then it was just like, I wound up like making a story that was like a little bit like darker and more serious than I intended. And I was like, oh, this is supposed to be the fun thing that I do. And then instead it's like, I don't know. I find it really, I don't know. Well, in the end, the show and Justin Theroux's character's research presents these pills as an alternative to therapy. It's like this Freudian thing of like, let me, destroy the like profession that has made my mother, let me make it obsolete, sort of thing.
Yes. And the scene where he just yells that is fantastic.
but in the end he's wrong, or is he right, or is he partially right, or whatever it is. Like, he needs his mom to come in and like help, and it's not just take these 3 pills and you never need therapy ever again. But what those 3 pills offer is this safe fantasy space for these 2 very damaged individuals to connect with each other in a way that they could never do in their ordinary life. And that, I think there's something really very beautiful about that, about the way in which they show these damaged parts of themselves to each other, and the way that they keep betraying each other's trust and fantasies, but like, or at least she betrays his trust over and over again in fantasy, but like that they keep coming back for and to each other. I find it very sweet and romantic. In a way that where it doesn't even necessarily end on like a deeply romantic note. It ends on like a friendship note. I mean, it could be a romantic.
It ends with him holding a puppy. Literally, holding a puppy.
it didn't play to me as romantic really at all. But like, like that sort of thing that she says to him at the end, where it's just like nobody's really that sane, and then it ties sort of back without exactly quoting it to the beginning fucking amoeba lecture, which I was like, oh yeah, I hope this pays off. Does pay off, where it's just like one out of so many contacts is the one that causes the change, like, for forever. And so it was, I thought it was really great, because I really didn't want it to go into romance.
Yeah.
If she was like, oh, hey, Now that I'm done with my father and my sister, now that Hank in the tub was actually Hank Azaria.
I know. Sorry. I thought that was funny.
Well, this is like the level of humor that is just like for humor's sake, which was enjoyable for me, but also kind of made me feel
by
weird.
The way,
but she doesn't go back to be in a romance with him. She goes back to be his friend.
But by the way, if you go back and watch it again from the beginning, which is what I did as soon as I finished it, you hear Hank Azaria he's in the Jersey. His voice is in the Jersey one, I think, is like the caller for like the Greta's Dr. Mantle Ray's radio show, something like that. Hank Azaria's voice is in the show before you see him at the very end. And I was like, ah. But the friendship thing, like I would say romance only because they play husband and wife in at least two of the dream sequences, right? So there is this like romance connection. But what's true of Jonah Hill's character is that he's never had a healthy relationship with an object of his affection or desire. It's always been these like worship from afar sort of, and then get like effed up and toxic sort of thing. And so the fact that it doesn't end, like he's afraid of repeating that pattern. The fact that it ends with friendship means no matter what, we hope he's not going to repeat that pattern with the Emma Stone character. And I love that it for that. The one Easter egg that I want to call out that I really appreciated because it wasn't like called out in a very big way is at the very end, you know, she breaks him out of the sort of mental health facility that he's been put into. And she has this whole scheme where they like change clothes in the bathroom and stuff like that. That's the plot. That's the beginning of Sugarland Express when Goldie Hawn breaks her husband out of jail. And she's like, I saw it in a movie once. It'll work. And I've just really appreciated it because the only reason I have ever seen Sugarland Express is because of the Steven Spielberg episode we did for Storm of Spoilers. So thank you, Storm of Spoilers, for making sure that I understood that very gentle reference at the end of Maniac. I appreciate it.
Nice. I found the end really fascinating in the sense that I was waiting for the show to take a stance one way or the other on whether or not on who was right, essentially between the two Mantle Rays, the mother or the son. And I think that it doesn't, I don't know if it, I don't know if it really takes a stance. It's more like, it's more of a, you know, cause I don't know if it necessarily says that they're fixed at the end, but it's sort of the message that I took away from it at the end was like, if we all have empathy and listen to each other, that'll make everyone a little bit better. So, cause that was like the thing is like the computer catches emotions. They program the computer with emotions. And that's sort of what at least the scientists think is throwing off their entire experiment. But also it's sort of what makes it kind of work for our two protagonists. They figure it out inside. And then. Yeah, I read friendship at the end. It's two friends and a puppy riding off into the, you know.
I mean, I think no matter
towards
what.
Towards Salt Lake City, I guess.
I think no matter what, it's like two partners. You know what I mean?
Right.
And like she had a partner in her sister and he's never had a partner. And no matter what, like they have.
Well, his partner was his imaginary brother.
Oh, sad. Yeah.
Well, and that was it. He was so isolated and in his mind invisible to the world that he created a partner for himself within his own head.
But like, I do, yes, I thank you for underlining that. I really like that. I do see how this show in ways is like, algorithmically designed to drive Dave insane because Dave does let, like, you're like, but what does the Rubik's Cube mean? And the truth is, like, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a Rubik's Cube.
We picked a symbol. Yeah. You know what was, like, the perfect example of why I was like, fuck you, show, right at the end, is she's with her dad, and her dad's being all nice at the table. And he's like, how was she? She's like, she's dead, Dad. It was all in my mind. He's like, was it? And I'm like, fuck you, show. Fuck you, show. Don't bring that up now. Like, you left it, you had her mention at one point, she's like, no, this is the neural ganglia to like other realities. And then Emma Stone's like, back into the neural ganglia or whatever. And then it's like, they reference it a few times, but come on.
No, I don't,
right as it was refocusing on the duel thing, it throws
it
out.
It really is a show
breadcrumb
that's going to piss off everyone who looks for hidden meaning in literally everything they see on screen.
Well, I don't think that, like, my interpretation is that the show never meant it that way. It's not like, or was it an alternate reality? It's like, or, are the memories of people that exist in our mind as real in their own way, the same way that, like, a real person is real.
So that sounds like somebody that doesn't realize this is just the OA, but we get to see what happens in the visions.
Well, somebody has.
Oh, you didn't watch the OA. That's right. Neil, get my joke.
Last thing that I want to say is a shout out to Julia Garner, who plays Emma Stone's sister in this show. And I just watched a bunch of Ozark, and she's great in that show, and she's great in The Americans, and she's been great in every movie she's done and stuff like that. So basically, if, like, Julia Garner shows up, I think you know you're in for a good time at the movies. So
yeah, it's funny. I was looking up the IMDb Pro page, because I'm very fancy IMDb Pro subscriber, and you can rank the cast by star meter. And I was like, holy shit, why is Julia Garner number 3 on the IMDb star meter? And I assume it's because Ozark just came out, right? And The Americans just won, or just almost won some awards.
It won 2 awards, The Americans.
Awards. Good to know.
Yeah. But anyway, Emmy
I
found
awards.
That fascinating.
I don't know, okay.
Emmy. yeah. Maniac, though.
No, it is surprising. Great. It is surprising that Julia Garner is so high, but she deserves it, so. Good job.
Right. Yeah, she rules in this show. She's great. Yeah. Everybody just kills it in this show. I feel like there's not even a weak link. So
now I want to rank. Now I want to rank by star-o-meter.
Well, like by performance-o-meter?
No, just by like how popular they are on IMDb.
You just want to rank by star-o-meter. Oh, got it. We got a click obsession coming up. I'm down with that.
Okay. I love this. I hope the other people love it. If you didn't, that's okay. It's dividing the TV critics big time. So, you know, who knows what you'll think of it, but I think it's like a much.
But it's not for the critics. It's for the fans. Sorry. It's hard to say that with a straight face.
Yeah, I think I'm on the middle of the road by it, but it's definitely very, very well executed, and anything I didn't like about it was my fault.
Yeah, it's definitely worth between 5 and 10 hours. I'm not entirely sure how long it really was of your time.
All right. Maniac will be on Netflix. Neil, what are we doing next week?
Oh, well, we're doing some stuff. We got some big plans. Joanna is probably right after we record this heading to the airport, and she will be joining me here in Austin, Texas. Me and like a million other people, for Fantastic Fest, which I'm very excited about. First of all, Fantastic Fest has a very good lineup this year. It's going to kick off with Halloween and, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote tomorrow night. And then, we'll talk about that next week. So that'll be fun. We'll talk. This is your first Fantastic Fest, correct?
It's my first time Fantastic Fest, but I was told it would just be you and me, Neil. This is the first time hearing that a million other people are going to be there. So
shit.
I'm a little bummed about that, but.
Yeah.
Our email invite went out to the entire group.
Oh no. Yeah, but it's Austin's big the Alamo Drafthouse's big genre festival. It is also the first year since a lot of turmoil and strife, if we remember. I think we talked about this on the podcast last year about how Fantastic Fest sort of blew up with a lot of bad stuff. You know, protecting sexual assaulters and women not feeling safe. And I am very curious to see how it feels this year. Cause last year was obviously, it was both tense and sort of comforting, which is weird because, their being there felt good. Like it felt good to talk to people and be at the festival that this will be my, either my 10th or 11th, I can't say for sure without doing math. So it'll be interesting to see. And then I'm very curious to get Joanna's take next week about her first experience with what is a very unique film festival. So yeah, we'll talk Fantastic Fest next week.
Nice. Fantastic Fest. I hope the, Fantastic Fest fever breaks when someone like Kat calls Jamie Lee Curtis and she breaks his face.
Oh, jeez.
What? No?
That's a
For
lot.
A Halloween premiere?
It's like That'd a lot a great wrapped Halloween up into premiere. One moment, but if I get to watch Jamie Lee Curtis punch a dude, I don't care why. It's great.
Yeah, that's a good point. Also, we could probably just see Halloween. Anyway, excellent. Until next week, guys, where can people find more of your work on the internet? And maybe, follow your Fantastic Festness, Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on VanityFair.com or follow me on Twitter at JoeWroteThis.
And Neil Miller.
Get me over on the FilmSchoolRejects.com where we actually did put up a list of 25 films we can't wait to see at Fantastic Fest. It's a big old list. You can also follow me on Twitter at Rejects, and don't forget to follow the show at Storm of Spoilers. And if you have questions, comments, thoughts, stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. I'm on Twitter at DA7E. I'm on Polygon.com talking about The Predator. And although they don't, support anything I say and I don't speak for the show, Teen Mom OG comes back October 1st. That's what I've been working on. So until next time, guys, thank you so much to our patrons, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, to get in on the Slack. And we will see you guys Fantastic Festival, post-Fantastic Festival, where hopefully you do not fall down.
No good, and you're the only one that's understood. I come along, but I don't know where you're taking me. I shouldn't go, but you're reaching, dragging, shaking me. Turn off the sun, pull the stars from the sky. The more I give to you.